Welcome to DivCasts from University of Chicago Divinity School. For more of our podcasts and information about our terms of use, please see our website, divinity.uchicago.edu/podcasts.
Good afternoon, everyone. Good afternoon. I'm Margaret M. Mitchell. I'm the Dean of the Divinity School and Professor of New Testament and Early Christian Literature. It is my pleasure to welcome you to this lecture this afternoon by Professor Abdul Karim Sarush. Professor Sarush is visiting professor in Islamic Studies for the winter quarter of 2012. This position is made possible by the University of Chicago Mellon Grant for the study of Islam at the university. I would like to thank in particular Professors Michael Sells, Fred Donner, David Nirenberg, and Tahar Akutpuddin, who serve as the steering committee for this program, which enables us to bring outstanding scholars of Islamic studies from the world over to campus to teach and to enliven the intellectual study of Islam at the University of Chicago. Professor Sarush is, by any possible measurement, just such a scholar. The founder and director of the Institute for Epistemological Research in Tehran and a research associate of the London School of Oriental and African Studies, SOAS, Professor Sarush is an internationally renowned Islamic philosopher and scholar of Islamic thought, including such topics as science and religion, Sufi mysticism, history and human rights. He is also a noted scholar and reciter of the poetry of Rumi. He is the author of some 30 books in Persian. Two, I say with hope, so far have appeared in English translations. One collection of his writings entitled Reason, Freedom, and Democracy in Islam, Essential Writings of Abdul Karim Sarush, which was published by the Oxford University Press in the year 2000. And in 2009, appearing from E.J. Brill, Expansion of Prophetic Experience, Essays on Historicity, Contingency, and Plurality in Religion. The title of his lecture this afternoon is Revival and Reform in Islam. We are eager to hear you this afternoon. Please join me in welcoming Professor Abdul Karim Sarush.
Good afternoon, everybody, and thank you, Professor Mitchell, and thanks, everybody, for being here and giving me an opportunity to discuss one of the main topics of concern for Muslims and non-Muslims alike, and that is the issue of revival and reform in Islam. The topic is wide enough, and I have to select from it part of the most important figures, most important trends in Islamic reform and revival in the history of Islamic culture and civilizations, and therefore I try to confine myself to a number of very prominent figures from Al-Ghazali's time down to the present time. I will be examining about five or six figures, and I will try to discuss their ideas and their contributions to the issue of reform and revival. Let me just begin with when reform or revival becomes necessary, and then go on to see if that necessity still is with us, or when actually in the history of Islam that necessity came up and drove some of the most important Muslim thinkers in order to provide some solutions to the puzzles and problems of their time. Now, of course, in Islamic history, we did not have a Protestantism, a reformation of church like what you had in the case of Christianity. Such a split never occurred in the Islamic history. Of course, the two big branches of Islam, Shiism and Sunnism, have been there from the early time of Islamic history. But nevertheless, such an institutional reformation which happened in the case of Christianity did not happen in the case of Islam, because I mean, there is at least one of the reasons is that there is no such institution in Islam as the church here in Christianity. But apart from that, of course, there have been cases of reform and revival in the history of Islam because of the following reasons that I am going to mention, and then I will go through them one by one and try to explain them. The first reason for reformation and revival is the case of the institutional corruption, which, as I said, perhaps it did not have any instances in the case of Islam. The second cause, perhaps, is the misinterpretation of doctrines and of the message of a particular religion, here Islam. And the third is the imbalance of the different parts of religion, such as what Ghazali actually decided to solve, and I will come to that. And the four is the misuse, political misuse of religion, which perhaps is one of the most urgent problems of the Muslims today. And the fifth is the maladjustment of religion to the needs of the time. So, I mean, roughly speaking, and I'm not going that this is the end of it, or perhaps you might find some other reasons or causes behind reform or revival in any religion, including Islam. But as far as I can see, and I can, you know, make an induction perhaps in the history of Islam, I would say that under these five headings, you might, cover or include the movements of reform in Islam. Now, let me begin with the first prominent figure, Abu Hamid al-Ghazali, who lived in the 5th century after the Hijra, or perhaps better known as a man who died in 1111, according to the Latin calendar. Now, why I choose him as a person in the top of the list is because he himself wrote a very hefty book in four big volumes called Ihya ul-Ulum or Ihya ulum al-Din, The Revival of Religious Sciences. Now, the very term revival appears in the title of the book. And that means, and that demonstrates, that early in the 5th century after the demise of the Prophet, there was an urgent need for a reform or perhaps a revival in Islamic doctrines or Islamic sciences, according to al-Ghazali. Let me quote you a sentence from one of the Ihya ul-Ulum actually contains 40 books or 40 chapters, if you like, but he prefers to call them 40 books. In one of the books of Ihya ul-Ulum, he has got a sentence which I think very explicitly, very clearly shows the intention of the writer and the goal of his endeavor in the field of Islamic revival. He says, alas, all religious sciences are in decline, save Sufism, which is completely dead. So this is by al-Ghazali very telling, and tells us very clearly what actually he wanted to revive. When he says that he is after reviving Islam, he means that something he would like to revive, something which is already dead. Of course, he tries his best in order to do something about all other half-living sciences, but his main effort is spent on reviving the dead science, if that can be called a science properly. I mean Sufism or mysticism, Islamic mysticism. So that is the main thing. According to Ghazali, actually, for him, there are a number of, you know, different religious sciences, law, philosophy, theology, morality, and so on. And Sufism, of course. which is very akin to morality, according to him. But his diagnosis was that the whole body of Islamic culture, perhaps, was ill. And that was because of the cancerous growth of law, to the cost and expense of slimness of morality. That was his diagnosis. He was himself a jurist, a very grand faqih. You know, he wrote a number of important books on usul al-fiqh, the philosophy of jurisprudence, on fiqh itself, law, sharia law. And he was one of the prominent, you know, students of Al-Juwayni, who was a grand theologian and a good jurist and so on. But nevertheless, after he finished his studies, he realized that perhaps fiqh was overgrown. It was too much fat. And something had to be done in order for fiqh to lose weight and for other Islamic sciences to become loftier, to become healthier, and so on. So that was one of the main diagnoses of Al-Ghazali. Therefore, he tried, as I said, his best in order to do something to lift up morality and Sufism, and perhaps to keep fiqh in its proper size and not to let it to become or to occupy a place which is too much for it. He goes on very long in order to write that not only fiqh has become, you know, very lofty, but in order to show that the fuqaha and the jurists, who were par excellence, you know, the Muslim scientists of the day, they were very arrogant people. They were very worldly people. Actually, this takes him to the point that he declares that fiqh or sharia or law is not a proper religious science. He says that morality is a religious science, but fiqh is not a religious science. It is a worldly science. And this is a very important recognition on the part of a very grand jurist of the time, who was himself, as I said, a great jurist. Nevertheless, he declares that fuqaha or ulama ud dunya, they are the scientist or the jurist of this world. And their discipline, their science, is good only for this world. It's not good for the next world. And if you are a Muslim by law, you will not, you know, receive happiness in the next world. You have to be a moral person in order to become happy in the next world. This is very explicit in his writings. And he downgrades, you know, law. And he tries to show that it has been very harmful, very pernicious, very deleterious to other sciences of religion. And in Ihya ul-Ulum, as I said, he tries to revive Sufism and to show that that is the heart of religion, that is the essence of religion. He has got these four thick volumes of Ihya ul-Ulum. Roughly 70% of the book is about morality, and the rest, one-third, is about law, about philosophy, about theology, and other things. Therefore, you would see that from this allocation of places and size, you can see the measure of the importance of things in the eyes of Al-Ghazali. Morality, you know, ranks very, very high according to him. So let us call fiqh or law an internal or a domestic enemy which needs reform. But then, according to Ghazali, there is an external, an alien enemy, which was already at work at the time of Al-Ghazali, and he tried again his best in order to suppress it. And that was Greek philosophy. He didn't like Greek philosophy, and he thought that it was a contamination, it was a threat to the whole Islamic sciences. It had misled most of Muslim philosophers and thinkers, and therefore, in order to revive Islamic sciences and reform Islamic sciences, philosophy had to be purged. And therefore, he, of course, I mean, studied Greek philosophy as far as he could, and he was able. He was a very smart, smart person. And then he wrote, you know, two books, as you know, Maqasid al-Falasifa which means the ideas of philosophers, and then he wrote another book, Tahafut al-Falasifah, which means contradictions of philosophers. And these contradictions of philosophers, he tried to show that philosophers contradict each other, and philosophy is not a reliable science. Never forget that Al-Ghazali, during his whole life, was after certainty. Certainty was his main goal in his life. And according to him, neither in philosophy nor in theology, you wouldn't find certainty. And in Ihya ul-Ulum, actually, he mentions, he advises us that please accept this piece of advice from somebody who has got the highest rank in theology, أعلى درجة المتكلمين, who has got the highest rank in theology. He gives you this free advice not to follow theology, not to study philosophy in order to attain certainty. That cannot be found in none of these two disciplines. Therefore, for him, as I am depicting, revival, first of all, meant the revival of Sufism, which meant the essence of religiosity, according to him, purging philosophy and downsizing law and fiqh. That was his, revivalism. You see that for Al-Ghazali, two things are very important, or perhaps for granted. One thing is that religion, all religion, including and especially Islam, has got an essence. And one, in order to reform it, has to purify it, has to take it back to its essence. So that is one task. It was for granted. He never argues about it. He never tries to explain or to prove that there is an essence to any religion. So he just take it for granted. The second thing that was for granted for Al-Ghazali was the identity of Muslims. He was not living in an age of identity crisis. Muslims were already very powerful. Some people have attacked, have accused, and have blamed, Al-Ghazali, because he was living in the time of the Crusades. No single word about Crusades are there in his writings, in his maybe 200 volumes that he has produced. No single word. And for that matter, of course, in Rumi also, you wouldn't find a single word about. And these two people have been castigated, have been blamed, have been taken to the task why they were ignorant, they were so forgetful about such a big event in their time. So there are a number of explanations about it, but I think for Al-Ghazali, who was a Sufi, first of all, and who did not bother about fighting, about, let us say, worldly matters. But the second reason was that for him, Islam already was so powerful that such fightings, such wars, such battles were nothing actually, did not matter anymore. And because of that, he did not pay much attention to such thing. And anyway, he didn't mention it. And by any standard, Muslims at that time were not going through an identity crisis such as they do nowadays, and I will come back to that. Therefore, his reform is not a reform of Muslims or Muslim or Islamic society, if you like. It is a reform of Islamic doctrines, a reform of Islamic sciences, according to him. For him, Khilafah, the political system of the time, was fine, was okay. And sometimes, actually, he did support, he did cooperate with the political system of the time. And as you know, he was emissary sometimes between the Shah, Malik Shah, and others in Iran, and the Khalifa in Baghdad. And he wrote the book Al-Mustazhiri, combating Ismailis in favor of the Khilafat, or Khalifa in Baghdad. So many things like that. So all this tells you that he was very self-confident about the Islamic identity of the Ummah. There was no crisis, but of course there was a crisis inside the Islamic doctrines, and the way that he found in order to do something and to revive it was as I mentioned before. Now let us leave Al-Ghazali, because Al-Ghazali himself is a vast continent. one can, you know, speak about him for hours and hours and hours, especially by a lover Al-Ghazali. So you have to stop me, otherwise I will go on and on and on talking about Al-Ghazali, and he's such a fascinating personality, such an attractive figure that you can talk about him, read him, and discuss him, you know, for a long time. And no wonder that he has been the, you know, the Muslim scholar par excellence, especially in the West. And no wonder that some people had said that had Muhammad not been the final prophet, then the next prophet after him would have been Al-Ghazali. So that is the prominent place that he occupies in the Muslim mind. Now, let us leave Al-Ghazali and actually move very fast for 600 years. And this time again to another Iranian author. Well, I am proud that both of these two persons that I am discussing at first are Iranians and come from Iran, and I take pride in them, actually. The second one is from Kashan, and not very far from Khorasan, which was the birthplace of Al-Ghazali. And this gentleman from Kashan lived around 1700 in Safavid period, and his name is Kashani, Faiz al-Kashani. He is, by and large, more or less a figure very much like Al-Ghazali, except that he is a Shiite. Both are Iranians, both are great scholars, both are jurists, both are philosophers. Of course, Faiz is a poet, which Ghazali was not. And both of them have written very prolifically and very extensively. And a unique phenomenon actually happened. In the time of Kashani and by Kashani himself. You know, what he did, which is unique in the whole history of Islam, is that he revived the revival of Al-Ghazali. You know, he re-edited, actually, the book of Al-Ghazali. This has no match, nothing comparable with it in the whole history of Islam. A prominent, an important book written by a prominent Sunni scholar being edited, republished by a Shi'i scholar 600 years later. So he did it. And the book now is everywhere, is published. And both books, of course, are in Arabic, except that Al-Ghazali made a abridgment of his book in Persian called Kimya-i Saadat, but Kashani, of course, did not do that. Now, he re-edited, or according to he himself, he revived the revival, Fi Ihya al-Ihya. The book, actually, again, the difference between these two books, Ihya al-Ulum and Ihya al-Ihya, only you can find the differences in kalam and in fiqh, in law. But when it comes to morality, when it comes to Sufism, which is, as I mentioned, 70% of the book, it is untouched. This is very important, even for the people who study Shi'ism and Sunnism. This is a very eye-opening, you know, and I have written extensively about these two books, and I have shown, you know, I have gone through these books page by page in order to show where are the agreements and where are the disagreements, the accords and discords, and to show that where two Sunni and Shi'i scholars differ seriously and where they do not differ seriously. It is superficial. It tells you, really, this is a very unique experience. It tells you that the infrastructure is morality, but the suprastructure is law and kalam. Shi'is and Sunnis actually do differ in kalam, of course, for Shi'is the successorship of Prophet and some other things is different from what Sunnis think and believe. And also, of course, the law, because in Shi'ism, law mainly comes from the infallible imams Whereas in Sunnism, of course, there are at least four schools, around four fallible figures who were prominent jurists and so on. There, of course, you will see that there are a lot of differences between the two scholars. But when it comes to the ideas of Al-Ghazali about, you know, vices and virtues, which is the main part of the book, vices and virtues, they see eye to eye. They have got the same idea, with one single exception. And that one single exception is that Al-Ghazali is pro-music, but Al-Fayz is not pro-music. And because of that, he has omitted that book, you know, from among the 40 books. Al-Ghazali is a very generous person, despite he was an ascetic, despite that he had his own, you know, ideas about religious, you know, practice. And despite that, many of the ulama of his time did not like music, and some of them actually found it forbidden by law, by the Prophet. But Al-Ghazali, you know, gives it a very extensive, you know, discussion, and comes up with very fascinating idea that music is forbidden for some people and is good for some other people, is not that good for some other people. So all depends on the subject. Nothing wrong with the music itself. Music, according to Al-Ghazali, which of course draws on another Sufi, it just agitates what is already in you. Already in you, if there are bad thoughts, therefore music will be bad for you, because it just agitates, stimulates, you know, those bad things. But if you are full of good things, then it stimulates that good things. Therefore, according to the person who listens to music, the you know, the music varies. I mean, becomes either forbidden or even obligatory or permissible and things like that. But although we know, I mean, from the biography of Fayz, that he did have a wife, and his wife was a musician, and after midnight, I mean, when Fayz was praying, his wife was playing, you know, music for him during his prayers. But nevertheless, he did not enter this in his theories. He just practiced it. And therefore, he omitted the Kitab al-Sama, the book on music, from Al-Ghazali. And you would not find such a thing in the revival of revival. Now, again, as I mentioned, Fayz Kashani actually himself was a philosopher. He was son-in-law of Sadruddin Shirazi, the great philosophers of Iran. Some people would argue that he was on a par, on the same footing of Ibn Sina, for example. He tries to synthesize, you know, mysticism, philosophy, and theology, and so on. So he was his son-in-law. And he studied philosophy under him. But towards the end of his life, actually, he rejected philosophy. He did not find it useful. And he wrote something, you know, dismissive about philosophy and theology. And actually, he declared that he regretted the part of his life that he spent in doing philosophy, in doing theology. So he opted for mysticism, like Al-Ghazali. So he was a Shi'i Ghazali, if you like. And Ghazali was a Sunni Kashani. So again, in the time of Fayz, you would see, again, I mean, the growth of fiqh, I mean, is accepted and endorsed by Fayz. And the hostility towards philosophy is there, you know, with Al-Kashani. Mysticism, again, is endorsed as the heart and the essence of religiosity. Of course, mysticism and morality coming from the infallible imams and according to their, you know, teachings, not coming from you know, Sufis. Faith did not like them. And the crisis of identity is not there. So far, we are not perhaps in an area of reform, I mean, per se. We are in an area of revival on both sides of Sunnism and Shiism, based on the idea of religious sciences and doctrines, and showing ways and solutions to the problems of religious sciences. Now, let me take you now to a gentleman from India in 18th century, who, although was not an Iranian, he did know Persian very well. And he did make, you know, a very good Persian translation of the Quran, you know. And alas, you know, I edited actually his Persian translation, but somebody else preempted me and said he had done it before, so you just stop and I will do it, but he never did it and I never did it, and so it has never been published, unfortunately. But for those of you perhaps who study, you know, translations of Persian translation of Quran, his translation is very careful, very precise. Some of the pitfalls and mistranslations that modern translators of Quran have made, you know, because of the unfamiliarity with the subtleties of the Arabic language, he has not, you know, been into. Therefore, but he was a jurist as well, a grand jurist, and he was a grand Sufi. He was from Mashayikh himself, and the Muhaddith, and all that. His name is Waliullah Dehlawi. He comes from India, and he is, as I said, again, a Sunni jurist, a Sunni Sufi. He was not a philosopher, of course. His main book, he has got many books, in Persian and in Arabic. And his main book is called Hujjatullah al-Balagha, The Divine Proof. Now, this divine proof, according to Dehlawi himself, is unprecedented. This is his judgment, and I think he is right in saying that. It is unprecedented. It is unmatched. It is not comparable with any other book written so far, I mean, until the time of Dehlawi in 18th century India. In the beginning of the book, actually, he mentions that in a dream he saw two grandsons of Prophet, Hassan and Hussein, who gave Dehlawi, gave him a pen, and they told Dehlawi that this is the pen of our father, of the Prophet. That was that. So the interpretation of the dream, according to Dehlawi, was that perhaps Prophet is encouraging him, is recommending him to write, to take down what he has got already in mind. Therefore, he began writing the book, Hujjatullah al-Balagha, the conclusive proof of God. In this book, he does not actually go the way that perhaps Al-Ghazali went, or Kashani and so on. His is very different. His is, I mean, let us say, quote-unquote, very modern, because it is sociological. It is not theological, it is not legal, it is not philosophical, it is sociological. Sociological in the sense that he takes into account the conditions of the people in the time of the Prophet, and he tries to show, to demonstrate, that Islamic Sharia is something that fitted the conditions of the Arab of the time. It was not meant to be eternal. It was not meant originally to be universal. This was a very daring idea on the part of such a jurist of 18th century. And according, I mean, to him, as I said, he says that nobody has even, you know, said something which comes close to what I say. He tries to show that perhaps most, 90%, 95% of Islamic precepts, Islamic law, Islamic Sharia, is the same as the Arab law of the time of the Prophet. He just copied them. He just endorsed them and then made it, you know, law for every Muslim. Therefore, we should not think that they come from heavens. We should not think that they are sacred laws. Such is not the case. So he tries to show one by one, for example, the penal law, especially the penal law, that if somebody murders, assassinates someone else, he should pay, you know, 100 camels, for example. He say, okay, there before the Prophet, it was 50 camels or 60 camels, and so he he recommended it. Actually, he came to the idea that it should be 100, and so on and so forth. Therefore, he tries to show that most of what is there already in the fiqh was there in the Arabic peninsula. The conclusion that he comes with is this, that the Islamic law is proportionate to the power of mind and body of people. And if that power of mind and body becomes different, then law should become different. Then, of course, he recommends us that Prophet, of course, could not, you know, force the Arab people to live radically differently. So he could not do that. Therefore, he did not, you know, legislate radically new laws. That was not his business, and that is not what he did. And on the other hand, he could not leave legislation to people to do whatever they want, to legislate whatever they want. All what Prophet did wisely, according to him, is just to train a particular people and to legislate for a particular people, and then tell other people and other generations to see their distances from the original people and to translate, you know, original ideas culturally to their culture. Exactly the way that translate Arabic into Persian, into English, into other things, they have to translate Islamic law into, let us say, Iranian law, English law, and so on and so forth, in order, first of all, to be, you know, followers of the Prophet, and, of course, in order to be able to solve their problems. So the rigidity of law, he doesn't do philosophy, he doesn't do theology, the rigidity of law has, you know, given its place to such a flexibility, which is very amazing. This is the way that he does his reform or his revival. He tries to give us or to show us the historicality of Islamic law, the historicality, the contextualization of the Islamic law, and tries perhaps to take away the sacredness. These wordings or terminology he doesn't use, but of course, I mean, it's quite implied by what he says. Now, moving from the Halawi to another Indian who was very familiar with the Halawi, and this time he was a reformist as well. He was not a jurist, but he was a philosopher, and he was a poet. And this figure is a figure no less than Iqbal Lahuri from India, around 1920, 1930. He was a genius by any standard. Of course, he did law, some law, or for some times he was a barrister, but he left it. And of course, one cannot call him or consider him as a jurist, a Muslim jurist, an expert in Islamic law. That was not the case. But he did philosophy both in Britain and in Germany. And his dissertation, his PhD dissertation, was about the philosophy in Iran, in Persia. And he was a poet, of course, a very good poet. He never visited Iran, but his Persian was excellent, better than mine, better than most of Iranians nowadays. And now we count him like a classical poet in Persian language. His poetry is on a par with some of the greatest classical Iranian poets. We read him, we enjoy his reading his poetry, and there are songs, you know, based on his poetry. And his poetry is not only poetry, it's philosophy, it's thinking. He was a thinker, like many of, classical Persian poets, like Hafez, for example, like Rumi,